18-1276, Donald Rummage v. Robert Goldberg. Attorney James O. Vollmar of Waukesha will argue first, and he represents Donald Rummage.
Thank you. Honorable Justices, Ms. Raiello, Dubas, and Armstrong, may it please the Court. This case involves a judgment my client had entered in 1986 against a property owned by one Reiner Kemling. Mr. Kemling is not in court today. The judgment was entered in favor of Mr. Rummage. It was docketed in Racine County, and neither the judgment debtor Kemling nor the grantee of the judgment debtor, also not in court, sought declaratory relief to release this judgment. The outrageousness of it is that $75,000 in cash was taken from this property because it was in foreclosure in 1989 before the sheriff's sale could take place. That $75,000 is comprised of approximately $20,000 that Mr. Kemling left the premises with, another $27,500 that was paid in to the speculator who bought the property from Kemling, and another $27,500, which comprises the split of the equity. In other words, the amount of money over $165,000, which this property was bought at when it had an appraisal of $220,000. Everyone at that time relied upon that $220,000 appraisal except Mr. Kemling. My client was unaware of it. That $220,000 appraisal at that time, the parties subsequently, within 30 days and prior to the sheriff's sale, agreed they would split that equity between themselves to the detriment of my client.
Well, just so I understand, cash, this is the amount over and above the $165,000 that was...
Well, out of the $165,000,
yes.
Mr. Kemling took approximately $20,000. He took $19,000.
You're using cash in another context. I mean, did you...
Proceeds of the sale.
Proceeds of the sale.
Which is a good homestead term.
Over and above for the liens, real estate, insurance. Is that what you're talking about?
The priorities to the homestead.
Over and above the priorities to the homestead. That's...
Okay. Those priorities, the mortgage, the taxes, they did take $339 out to pay a title policy, but...
We're going to forget that.
Forget
right?
that, $339. $19,500 was taken out by Kemling, which were the proceeds of his voluntary sale, if you want to call it. That is undisputed that that would be the proceeds of the sale of a homestead, and that's what's exempt.
The second $27,500, I understand the first $27,500. That's
right.
When the property sold for $195,000, right?
It sold for
$192,500.
And that was a split of $55,000 based upon an appraisal.
Well, that's quite speculative, isn't it?
The
second $27,500? I mean, because that's the appraised value, but you and I know that appraised value, you can sell it for more than appraised value, or you can
sure.
sell it for less.
Right.
But in terms of actual cash, we're looking at $20,000, which is what Kemling got.
And then the guy he sold it to took $27,500.
Took $27,500.
From the next buyer.
Right.
Okay, and how they reached what I got into the other $27,500 is how they reached the agreement to get to that price.
Right.
They reached the agreement by reason of an appraisal that they had.
Now, how much of that do you claim you have coming? Because there is a $40,000 homestead exemption.
All right. I claim that the homestead exemption is a priority to my client and that my client is entitled to everything over the homestead exemption.
So he's entitled to everything over $40,000?
He's entitled to everything that wasn't claimed. You have to elect the homestead exemption. If Mr. Kemling elected to take $20,000, he can't elect to take $40,000, nor can they elect for him.
Okay. So your position then, if I understand it, is... Kemling was entitled to a homestead up to $40,000. He got $19,000,
right?
So his $19,000 in cash is exempt from your client's
lien,
although he still owes the money as a personal debt.
He still owes the money as a personal debt, and that lien stays on the real estate.
Okay. Now, that's really the issue.
Correct.
That's the issue in the case, if I understand the case. Does the lien stay with the property? And your position is that the judgment lien stays with the property.
Until some action is taken by some party to satisfy it, release it, or extinguish it by declaratory relief.
Why? Why can't you say, which is what I understand the other party to say, maybe I'm wrong, that once the person with the homestead exemption, which was Kim Erling, sells that property, that the homestead exemption is gone?
The reason that that was what was being done in the 1800s before 1901, when the limit was, a monetary limit was another limitation on the homestead. So not only did you have a limitation by acreage, you now had a limitation by value. And once you set the limitation by value, you have to have a determination of value before you can extinguish the lien.
So determination of value by what, fair market value, by sales?
Well, I say when you start a foreclosure action, it's by share of sale. The statutory procedure is by share of sale. And if you disagree on the price, you have a right to move forward to a share of sale. And if you move forward to a share of sale and the price isn't achieved at the share of sale over and above the homestead exemption, you pay.
Well, why hasn't that issue already been determined?
Because
the trial court sent it back for the trial court to determine fair market value, correct? And there was a hearing, and you took testimony, and the judge decided that $165,000 was a fair price. This was an arm's length transaction. That issue is not even before us now, is it? That's been decided.
What the Court of Appeals did is the Court of Appeals sent it back for two reasons. It said to determine the priority of the liens, number one, and number two, to determine the proper fair value. I believe that the proper fair value is determined that year, at the time it was sent back, at a share sale in that county, not in 1989.
But what was the issue that the Court of Appeals didn't, as I understand this, Court of Appeals told the trial court, you determine whether this $165,000 was fair market value. And the Court of Appeals said yes.
I don't believe they said the way you paraphrased it, determine whether 165 is the upset price, the fair value in foreclosure, use a foreclosure value. All they did is say it's sent back to you to determine the proper fair value. I think that's the term they use, proper fair value. But the point I'm making on that is that that is to make a nunk-pro-tunk decision of values in 1989 using what? The appraisal, the assessments at that time, testimony from others about what it was 10 years ago, a determination that this voluntary sale, which doesn't cut off a lien because all the cases say that, is the fair value that is what we should determine or as a source of fair value. Just as an aside, the values at that time that are pretty much everyone agrees, the values at that time, the tax bill in 1989 had the value, fair market value, of $199,300. The 1990 tax bill, this was mid-year, so the tax bill for the following year, which wasn't assessed, but usually assessed January 1, was $211,000. The appraisal was $220,000.
Were those full value? I'm talking about the tax bill. They say on the tax bill,
it was the fair market.
Fair market, this was 100%.
Yeah, that's not the assessed value. That's the fair market value.
Okay.
Right. And then The court, when it sent it back, just to answer Justice Babich's question, is the court exercised the wrong test. Test of value, which it cited the case, which is First Wisconsin National Bank versus KSW, says the proper fair value is not the value determined as a price to a speculator. It's the value determined by a price to the ultimate user. The ultimate user is still in the property. That ultimate user paid $192.5. So even following the standard that the court used, the standard was misapplied because the standard was, I'm going to confirm the sale to the speculator because obviously this was under stress. Well, it wasn't under stress to my client. My client didn't know about it. Where's the due process here? My client was entitled to the due process notice. Even if they argue it's a commercially reasonable sale, there's an entitlement to notice as to the price being sold or other things that are related to that so my client can object. My client wasn't in the circle. He was kept out of the loop. Now, that's the only way my client can be defrauded in this case is if he's outside the loop. And the only way his lien can be extinguished is by taking action at the time you want it extinguished. And then you don't go back, I don't think, in 1990 or 1999 and say, well, let's look at the price in 1989 and see what it brought then. You have to determine what are the priorities today. Priorities that today are that a person bought subject to a judgment lien. Title policies all have on them. These judgments are encumbrances on this property and need to be dealt with. If the insurance company wants to take the risk because the man's in bankruptcy, that he's going to have that discharged, but it doesn't get discharged, they took that risk. And that risk is that those judgments are liens on that property, and that's why they appeared on that title policy to be dealt with. And when they don't deal with them, when they overlook them, or they agree between themselves to overlook it, then my client's judgment lien isn't affected. So the real question here is, what affects my client's judgment lien? What affected my client's judgment lien in 1989? I don't believe anything. I think in 1989, my client's judgment lien stood as it was. And that it stood against, and to argue that by statute, the judgment lien doesn't attach to homesteads is not what it says. The statutes in 106.15 says it doesn't attach to the exempt homestead. It refers to another statute, but in fact, if you look to that statute, it defines exempt homestead and homestead separately now. Homestead is now land. Homestead exemption is the value of land up to $40,000.
Mr. Bollmer, except for that EPF case, isn't there a long line of cases decided by the courts in Wisconsin that are in direct opposition to the position you're taking here?
No, every one of those cases, all the cases, and if you want to talk about specific cases, I could address them, but all the cases are consistent with the statutes in place at the time. In 1849 and 1850, up until 1901, all the cases, homestead and homestead exemption, were interchangeable. The exemption was the homestead. The homestead was the exemption. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
What is so significant in 1901 about putting in a cap? But how does that change the scheme? Because the cases that I've looked at since 1901, including well into the 40s, seem to say the same thing. They don't seem to distinguish and say the cap that was brought into the law in 1901 changed anything. And I'm asking you, outside of the EPF case, what case can you point to that supports your position? What Wisconsin case can you point to?
Wisconsin case that says the lien of my judgment attaches to the homestead?
And supports your position fully.
All the cases that have been decided, none of the cases that have been decided prior to this, First, they're all fact-intensive, but if you sort through the facts, they're all mortgage foreclosure cases, they're execution cases, or the sales have taken place, or they've stipulated the values. All those cases are, we've stipulated to the value at $13,500, and for purposes of this argument, we're going to agree it's $13,500. Or there are already cases where the sales have taken place. There's not a case where they've gone back, except in Carefree, where anyone's gone back and said, let's take a look at what the status was at the time of the sale, and Carefree stands for my position. Carefree is not a homestead case, but Carefree stands for the Carefree Homes case, stands for the position that a private sale does not release the lien of the judgment, even if it's for full value. Even if it's for full value and all the money was used to pay priority creditors, Production Credit Association, which was a party to that case, Carefree Homes, Production Credit Association's lien was entitled to survive that, was entitled to a priority, and the people built a home on the property, and they even were allowed because the mortgage wasn't taken care of. And the argument here is that, well, this is a homestead case, so you can disregard Carefree. So Carefree Homes is that case. An EPF case is a case which talks about the zone of protection. An EPF case talks about who's entitled to the exemption. In this case, it's Kemling, his wife, and family, if he had one. That's the zone of protection. And that case, EPF says, if you take your money and leave, the exemption follows your money, and you're gone and you're protected. Now, these new people who buy subsequent to that, they're not entitled to the protection of your exemption.
Why is it, and under EPF, it seems like that as a lien holder, you would have greater chance of recovery and greater rights against a subsequent purchaser than you would the initial and original debtor. That seems
right. It's the same thing as
problematic.
I hate to use a worn-out phrase. Well,
but
if you're looking at the equity of the situation, if there's a mortgage and the mortgage, first the lien attaches to the homestead, I have to take as a given because what happens is, if you pay off the mortgage, the lien moves up in priority. If someone else pays off the mortgage, the lien moves up in priority. If you pay your taxes, the lien moves up in priority, or at least moves up in value. So, for example, if you pay your taxes or you don't pay your taxes, affects the lien. The lien is subordinate to those. And the homestead exemption is nothing more than a priority to my judgment lien. And as the homestead exemption leaves, like the mortgage is paid, my lien moves up in priority. It needs to be dealt with at the time of the sale, for sure.
Now, suppose Mr. Kemmerling had vacated this property as the homestead.
He did.
And does that exemption still apply to that property?
If he vacates the property without the intent...
Before he sold the property. Let's just say, before he sold the property, he got out of there.
Right.
Bought a home, that became his homestead.
Right.
What happens to your lien?
My lien moves up in priority and his homestead drops. He only has one homestead, the one he chooses. If he chose to have another homestead, that homestead replaces this one.
So your judgment lien at any one time might be a homestead, might be subject to the homestead exemption and might not be.
Correct.
And in effect, then, you're saying when he got out of there and got rid of the homestead by the sale, that ended the homestead exemption.
Correct. And at that point, the buyer or the seller should have sought to get rid of the judgment by either getting it extinguished on the basis of value or taking formalities necessary to do that. And they didn't.
And whoever purchases that home.
And whoever buys it subject to your judgment lien and does not have a traveling homestead exemption, that's your position in effect.
Well, he has a traveling homestead, I need to correct that a little bit, I think. The traveling homestead exemption, the homestead exemption follows the debtor to the homestead he chooses. If he already owned the other house, and then he moved into it and claimed it as his exemption, under those, under the cases, my client's priority would be ahead of his homestead. But if he bought a new homestead, a purchase money homestead, both that, that purchase money homestead is ahead of my, that, that homestead is ahead of my judgment lien too, on a new purchase.
On a new purchase.
Right. And if he's using the proceeds of the former sale also, they're exempt.
But that didn't happen here.
Well, it could have happened here. He moved to South Carolina and took his money with him. He had vacated this property. Mr. Kemmling. Mr. Kemmling, one of the reasons that they talk about value in the trial court was Mr. Kemmling's grass had grown up to be this high. He wasn't living in the house. It was vacant. And it had been vacant for some times. The reason I'm pointing that out is because that issue wasn't permitted to be handled in the trial court because they said it's presumed it's his homestead because he elected it in the bankruptcy court. He had elected it in the bankruptcy court as his
homestead. Now, is this the homestead of anybody else?
No. Well, subsequent to my judgment lien, yes, Mr. Goldberg, the second buyer, moved into the first buyer was Burmeister. He was a speculator. The second buyer, Mr. Goldberg, who's a defendant in the trial court and a respondent here, he and his wife still reside in the property.
But I assume that the argument is that because there's a recorded judgment lien, his homestead lien can't take precedent over yours.
He doesn't have a priority, correct.
Okay.
He's a subsequent purchaser. And takes subordinate to the priority lien.
So your position is that the person who has the homestead exemption, when that person sells, that's the end of that homestead exemption in terms of priority to your judgment lien. Anyone who buys subsequent thereto takes
subject
to your lien and any liens that have priority to you,
right.
Like taxes, like a prior mortgage.
Those, right. If they had taken subject to the mortgage, that would be a priority, but they elected to pay the mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
That mortgage... They could have assumed the mortgage, they could have assumed the taxes, and they could have assumed all of the obligations to that property, and some of these cases do that.
So it's just one homestead on that home, and then your lien takes priority. So that's what I was trying to follow. Yeah.
Well, there was
originally a
first and second mortgage, taxes, and then Kemmling's exemption, and then my judgment lien. That's correct. In any case, I think the important thing here that I wanted to bring across is that Kemmling's exemption was $20,000 because that's what he elected as his exemption. There's an election. He elected that as his exemption. The rest of the money taken from this property in the form of another sale within 30 days to not a speculator but to an ultimate user who still remains in the property. If any value is going to be used, it has to be the value that was used. If you're going to do it in the form of a foreclosure, a review of a foreclosure action, like it's either an upset price or it's a fair value determination versus fair market value, if you're going to go into that private sale as if it's a sheriff's sale, you have to look at the sale by the person who's ultimately going to use it and who bought it before the sheriff's sale could take place. Both of these sales took place in approximately 50-day period of time before the sheriff's sale could take place. So they walked away with I'm going to say in cash, $47,389 in actual cash. Burmeister walked away with $27,500, and Kemmling walked away with $20,000. And to argue, as... they did in trial court, and apparently successfully, that hey, we can look at the 165 price as if it's a foreclosure sale. I don't think is the first. It's not the proper standard, and I don't think you can do a non-pro-tunc valuation when the relief is not requested until 8 years later. You have to. You can't do this on a non-proton basis. Why don't we do then what we didn't do, and what they should have done? We'll do it now.
Well, counsel, it strikes me that, and correct me if I'm wrong. And boy, I don't pretend to know a lot of this. I can hardly figure out judgment.
But it's very tough for me to say you're wrong.
If we were to follow you and say that the lien attaches to the property, wouldn't we necessarily always end up with foreclosure sales? Why would anybody purchase a property to which a lien has attached?
They wouldn't. What you do is you follow the statutory procedure, and what you do is you call the judgment creditor and ask him for a release. He's got 10 days to give it to you. And if he doesn't give it to you, you can bring a motion in the trial court to ask that the trial court release the lien. And in 95% of the cases, maybe 100% of the cases, if you request a person to release the lien in accordance with the statutory procedure, the person will take a look at, let's see what the value of this is, call the guy back and say, well, I'm looking at the tax bill and it says it's worth $199. Hey, I think there's some value here. I'm not going to release my lien. I want to get paid something if I'm going to release my lien, because why should you be able to sell it for $165 when $199 is the value on the tax bill? Or let me have it appraised and I'll tell you. That due process wasn't granted to anyone here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vollmar. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Now, I have a series of speakers next, attorneys, and I'll make sure they were all on the same time wave. 12 and a half minutes to Mr. Is it Dubas? Representing Mr. Goldberg. 12 and a half minutes to Mr. Aiello, representing Advantage Bank and Bank of Elmwood. And 5 minutes to Mr. Armstrong, who's representing the amicus curiae, Wisconsin Land Title Association. Correct? Okay. We'll proceed with you, Mr. Dubas.
Good morning. My name is Mike Dubas. I'm an attorney practicing in Waterford, Wisconsin, and I represent Robert and Janet Goldberg. I'd like to begin, if I may, by addressing a point that Justice Crooks raised with respect to what change has occurred. In other words, why would the change in the Wisconsin exemption statutes placing a monetary amount, how would that possibly affect what we're doing here? Well, the answer is it doesn't. In fact, the Leitz case, which was decided in 1947, after we have a monetary amount, cited Smith, the case that held that a judgment lien does not attach to an exempt homestead. Leitz cited Smith with approval. So the fact that we've gotten a change, and the change again to me is insignificant, but the fact that we now have a monetary amount doesn't affect the underlying principle, namely that a judgment lien simply does not attach to an exempt homestead. The statutes say that. The case law, except for the Hoyle versus White case, which was the case way back when, before the statute was changed, except for that case back in the 1850s, every case that we have found that this court has held has indicated that a judgment lien does not attach to an exempt homestead. I'd like to proceed to what Justice Bradley indicated, a question she had. Your Honor was certainly correct when you stated that under the theory advanced by the appellant, they are in a much better position by not collecting from the judgment debtor, but collecting against an innocent third party. EPF stated, let's have a zone of protection. Let's do something here to protect the judgment debtor. Let's give him his $40,000 equity exemption, but we won't protect anybody else. The inconsistency in that is it's really no zone of protection at all. What buyer will ever purchase a piece of property in which there is a judgment against the seller if there's even 4,000 equity, 5,000 equity, 20,000 equity? They won't do it. Seller can walk away with his 40,000. Buyer is stuck. Mortgage companies are stuck.
Well, that's right. I mean, I dealt with a lot of real estate when I practiced law. You don't buy property with the liens unless there's enough equity in there, and then you take a calculated risk. And when you buy the property, you know you're buying subject to these liens.
Respectfully submitted, Your Honor, with respect to homesteads, this Supreme Court and the statutory authority, 806.15, 8.15.20, sub 1, the statutes all state, and the case law states, that a judgment lien does not attach to an exempt homestead.
Yep, a counsel, is always a question as to whether it's a homestead. And there's, if there's acreage, there's a question of how much
right.
there's homestead. And if there's this flat amount of $40,000 now. So if I represented a buyer, I certainly would not take it on the guarantee that this was homestead and that I'm free of this lien. What I would say is I want title insurance. Let them take the risk. I'm not taking the risk.
Correct, Your Honor, and that's what occurred here.
That's right.
The title insurance companies, and it, by the way, Your Honor, it was homestead, it was less than $40,000 in this case, and the acreage certainly met it. All the concerns that Your Honor addressed here occurred in this case.
Well, if that's true, and Kemmerling was homestead, and he had $40,000 or less.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, then it seems to me the homestead's gone. And that the person who buys it doesn't have a traveling homestead exemption except for himself, and he's buying that property subject to the judgment.
Well, Your Honor, if that is the court's position, it is contrary to the Smith case, the Ohio casualty case. And if I might make one other point, I raised this in my brief initially, but I didn't think I'd have to actually go into it, but Gulberg's, this is their homestead too.
I understand that.
If one reads the 815.20 sub 2, which is the statute that allows a owner of a homestead to remove a judgment, if that is the court's position, that this judgment lien really is there, which, again, we feel it is not. In that case, Goldberg filed a motion for summary judgment. We counterclaimed to remove the judgment lien. If one looks at that statute says grantors, grantees. It is not limited to the judgment debtor.
But it is limited to less than $40,000 in value.
Yes, Your Honor. No. And at that case, if the court, that record, when Gulberg filed his motion in 1995, the record will show he had less than $40,000 equity. Judge Flynn granted that motion, and summary judgment was entered. Case went up to the Court of Appeals in Rummage 1. Judge Nettersheim sent it back, saying that summary judgment wasn't appropriate to establish value. And we're not even taking issue at that point. Judge Flynn said, on the record, there's less than $40,000 equity. Judge Nettersheim says, no, you have to have a factual determination. It was sent back to determine whether or not there was less than $40,000 equity. Mr. Vollmer raised the issue of fair value, fair market value. I would like to point out that that issue was not raised by the appellant to the Court of Appeals. It was only, or to the trial court on the motion for reconsideration. It was only raised to this court. So the issue on Judge Simonic using fair value as opposed to fair market value, I see it only raised to this court. It was not raised to the trial court. It was not raised to to the Court of Appeals in Rummage 2 that certified this case up.
Why doesn't EPF make sense? As I read EPF, Court of Appeals was saying that, look, the law intends to protect the original homeowner. But why should it protect anybody beyond that? That makes at least superficial sense.
From a practical, non-legal standpoint, Your Honor, from a practical standpoint, I believe it makes no sense because you will not have real estate sales. What buyer is going to wait? It's not a motion, by the way. It's a declaratory judgment action that has to be begun. It's not a motion in the trial court the way I read the statute. What buyer is going to go to court and sit there and say, I'm going to have a... He sends the notice, the man made release the lien. Judgment creditor sits on it. Why should he respond? He's upset. He's going to lose his money. Why should he do anything? He sits on it. You have to begin your action. What buyer is going to sit here for 2 years, or like in this case, 4 years, to determine the priority of a judgment lien? The zone of protection is illusory at the best. It doesn't protect the seller. He's not going to be able to sell his property. Besides, this is, again, totally contrary to the case law of this court, the statutory law. I believe it was Justice Crooks that indicated this court has held, and there is no doubt about, there are no cases that support the position that is advanced by the appellate. There's no.
What's the basic policy behind those cases? What's the fairness in those rulings?
The fairness is, Your Honor, that a judgment lien in and of itself does not attach. Now, if there's a question on value, like Chief Justice Abramson raised, a question on acreage, a question of whether it is the homestead, those people can do the exact same thing that Mr. Rummage did. They can come to court and execute on their judgment. One point I want to raise, too, we were talking about equity here, and who's not been given a chance or who has been deprived. The record reflects in this particular case, Your Honors, that in 1989, Mr. Rummage, this is 89, came to the Gulbergs' house and found out they had purchased that house. He also knew that they were going to put improvements. In fact, he came out there to bid on a job. He waited 6 years to start this lawsuit. So if we're looking at equity in this particular case, Your Honors, he sat 6 years, and the record is not disputed that the Gulbergs made $68,000 in improvements, not cosmetic repairs, improvements. That's not been disputed in the record. Mr. Rummage, had he bought the first judge, had he bought out the senior loan positions, couldn't have gotten any money. Kemmeling walks out with 19 grand. If the property sold for 20,000 more, let's say that the 165 to Burmeister was too low. If it sold for 185, there'd still be a 39,000 equity. He still wouldn't have got anything.
Counsel, I want to follow up on Justice Babich's question as he was addressing EPF. It sounded in part like you have a $40,000 exemption. That's it. That's what the homestead exemption is on EPF. When I think of, and then the rest of the property value is not subject to homestead exemption. It's non-homestead exemption property. Let's say you have a vacant lot. You own that. That certainly is non-homestead property. You have a lien against it. You sell it to a subsequent purchaser. The subsequent purchaser looks and says, hey, there's a lien on it. And shouldn't that subsequent purchaser do something to it? You suggest the sky is falling. There will be no buyers of homestead property because the liens may carry on with the property. Why is it any different than the vacant lot?
Because the vacant lot is obviously not homestead, Your Honor.
Why is it any different than the vacant lot as to the amount above $40,000 that is not homestead?
As to the vacant lot, there would be no exemption, period. There is no exemption as to the vacant lot whatsoever. And that's why, for example, the Carefree case was a non-homestead case. That's the only case that I can find that can be cited here that a private sale does not extinguish a judgment lien. That was a non-homestead case. You take a look at Leith's, you take a look at Tuff, you take a look at Ohio Casualty as late as 1964. We call that late. It's the latest, one of the latest cases we have. I guess I have to stop.
No, you may finish the sentence.
If you look at, this could be a long sentence.
We're accustomed to that.
I'm sorry. If you look at Ohio Casualty, Cop, Leith's, all these cases say, and the statutes that they refer to, and the Smith case and the Carver case that they cite with approval, a judgment lien does not attach to an exempt homestead. There is no piggyback because it never attached to begin with. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Aiello.
Good morning. I'm Tom Aiello. I represent two of the defendants in this case, Advantage Bank and the Bank of Elmwood, who are the current mortgage holders on the property. Before I begin the points that I wanted to bring up, I want to clarify an issue that may be in the back of your minds in terms of the facts in this case, and it arises out of a question that Justice Abramson brought up, and that is, was this property Mr. Kemmeling's homestead? And I can unequivocally say it was, because the party stipulated to the fact that it was his homestead both before the sale to Mr. Burmeister and at the time of the sale and the closing to Mr. Burmeister. And if you review the record on appeal, you will see a written signed stipulation of facts entered into between the parties, and that's where you'll find that factual conclusion. So that shouldn't be an issue in this appeal at all. The issue that has been certified to this court by the Court of Appeals is stated as follows. Is the holding in EPF Corporation a correct interpretation of the homestead exemption law? We, the respondents, answer that question obviously no. It is an incorrect statement of the law. The Court of Appeals stated the issue a little bit differently when it said the fundamental question that the Court of Appeals certified is whether a duly docketed judgment lien attaches to the debtor's homestead property. The Court of Appeals recognized that EPF was, what the way they phrased it, was facially at odds with prior holdings of the Supreme Court. Well, I would submit to you that EPF is more than just facially at odds with prior Supreme Court holdings. EPF is in direct contravention of 806.15(1), 815.20(1).
Those are all in dispute, of course, counsel. The statutes, your opponent interprets those statutes differently. And that's where I'm coming from. Okay, I've got to decide here between how to interpret a statute, and I have in front of me EPF, which says one thing, you know, gives me one law. And I have a line of cases which I think, at least right now, I believe, gives me another law. The long line of cases favors you, the EPF case favors him. As a practical, equitable, just result, why is this line of cases better than EPF?
Because EPF was decided incorrectly because it ignored the statutes in question. EPF cite 806.15 sub 1.
Counsel, you don't understand my question, or I'm not putting it right. I'm asking you for the equities here. What's fair? If I'm starting on a fresh slate, and actually we are, because we've got a court of appeals case that says one thing, and we've got a line of cases that says another, what is the policy supporting your side? Not that the statutes say it is, because that's in dispute. What is it going to harm commerce? Is it going to is the sky going to fall down? Or, why should we go with you?
Because this court has stated long ago that the homestead exemption right of a homeowner is a very crucial, important right.
But maybe they're wrong. Why aren't those cases wrong?
Because the court continues to reaffirm those cases time and time again. If you go back to 1883...
Well, that's the kind of answer I used to get from my parents when I'd say, why can't I do it? And they'd say, well, because nobody else does it. If you're hearing frustration in my place, it's because I don't want to hear that answer. I want to get into the guts of it. Why are those cases wrong? Or why is EPF wrong? Or why are those cases right as a matter of policy, public policy?
Those cases are right because this state, via the legislature and via this court, have determined that a party's right to own a homestead takes priority over rights of creditors who may have liens on other pieces of real estate that is not homestead, and they want individuals to be able to own their own homes and to own a home, to sell a home, and leave from that transaction with money to purchase a new home. Home ownership is apparently an inherent right that this state has recognized back until the point when the first homestead exemption law was passed.
In the statute, at least in subsection 2 of the provisions we've been talking about, says that the homestead exemption goes to a grantee, an heir, and et cetera, right?
Yes.
And that makes sense because if there's a homestead exemption, you want the person to be able to transfer property and get advantage of that homestead exemption. Otherwise, there's no homestead exemption
right.
Anything. Okay, I buy into that. And that's public policy set forth by the legislature. That's your point.
Right? Correct.
Okay. And that's what happened here. You had a person with homestead exemption and sells to somebody else. And so that, according to you, the homestead exemption continues on the property.
No, the homestead never attached. The judgment lien never attached.
That's where I have a little problem. Explain why. If you take your position, isn't Kemmerling getting more than the $40,000 exemption? Because under your position, that judgment lien disappeared. Right? Rummage's judgment lien disappeared from this property.
No. The judgment lien never attached to the property. It never attached the day before the sale to Burmeister.
No. The judgment lien was good, except for $40,000.
The judgment lien attached to any equity in the property in excess of $40,000. I agree with that.
That's right. So that judgment, if Kimmerling had sold that property for, they gave him an equity of more than $40,000, right?
Okay.
The buyer of that property would have a judgment lien for the excess amount.
And his lien, the cases tell us, follow that money. His lien follows the money.
So he's only got a lien for $40,000. He lends this guy, Kimmerling is in debt for $122,000. The judgment lien is docketed appropriately. Judgment liens become liens on real estate.
Except the homestead.
right?
Except the homestead, except the exempt homestead.
But the exempt homestead is $40,000.
Correct.
So you're telling me that there's only a lien on the on excess of $40,000, and it disappears from property.
Correct.
That's your position.
That's my position. If in fact this trial court would have determined that the fair market value or the fair value of this real estate was, let's say, $192,500 at the time of the sale to Burmeister.
Let's say it's $1 million and Burmeister buys it for $1 million.
Okay.
Liens are only $300,000, let's just say, other than Rummage's lien. So now we've got Kemmerling walking away with $700,000, right? Only $40,000 of which is exempt, right?
Only $40,000 which is exempt.
But now Rummage is in the dark on all this, and Kemmerling has now gotten rid of all the money, so he's judgment-proof. And you're saying that there's no judgment lien on the real estate.
No, in that fact situation, if Mr. Rummage would then bring a lien foreclosure action, as he did in this case, I think that lien would attach to the equity between the $1 million.
That equity is gone. It's been dissipated. I want to know about whether there's a lien on the real estate.
I think the argument can be made that there's a lien on the real estate in excess of the $40,000.
And why don't you lose here?
Because the trial court determined after evidence was submitted, that the fair value of this property on the date of the sale to Burmeister, May 31st, 1986, was $165,000. In making that finding, it did the math and determined that Mr. Kemmerling's equity was then less than the $40,000 homestead exemption. So that money and the property was free of the lien. Exempt is defined in section 815.18 sub 2 sub h as free from the lien.
Counsel, isn't your position contrary to counsel that just argued before you? He concluded his comments with, there is no piggyback here because all of the cases say it never attached to the property to begin with.
No, I agree with that. There's no
You're saying it does. There is a lien, just not to the exemption part of the property.
Right.
So you're saying something different.
Well,
it seems to me you're saying there is a lien to the property, but not to the $40,000 exemption.
There's a lien
on
the
property.
Equity of the property in excess of
$40,000. Isn't that different than saying there is no piggyback because all of the cases say it's never attached to homestead property to begin with?
The term piggyback is used by EPF, and I think what EPF is saying there is that the subsequent purchaser is trying to, the second purchaser removed is trying to assert the homestead exemption of the original seller. We're saying that's not necessary because the lien never attached to the real estate, that portion of the real estate that was fully exempt. And that in the facts of this case, based upon the trial court's determination that fair value was $165,000, the property was fully exempt. The equity was within the $40,000 homestead exemption, so there's nothing to which this lien could have attached. I point out that EPF nowhere cites 806.15 sub 1. Mr. Vollmar only mentioned 806.15 sub 1 one time in his entire argument. He cannot get around the clear language of 806.15 sub 1, nor the language of 815.20 sub 1. Thank you.
you, Mr. Aiello. Mr. Armstrong.
May it please the court, my name is Tom Armstrong, and I'm representing the amicus, in this case, the Wisconsin Land Title Association.
Are you the one that ultimately pays up?
That's correct, Your Honor. That is the case.
You hold the bag here.
We hold the bag, and the association has written hundreds and hundreds of title insurance policies relying upon what it felt until the EPF decision in 1997 was very clear and unequivocal Supreme Court precedent and very clear and unequivocal statutes, which provide that a judgment lien does not attach to fully exempt homestead property. I know there's been some confusion here about whether it's homestead property, exempt homestead property. The key word here is fully exempt.
What does that mean?
That means that the equity of the debtor owner, the one claiming the homestead, is less than $40,000. That's the current statutory limitation.
Now say that sentence to me again.
Okay. Fully exempt means that...
No, the one before that. Now that I know what fully exempt property is, tell me what...
The position that the Supreme Court has taken since 1858, when it did change the law, the legislature consciously changed the law so that fully exempt homestead property is not subject to a judgment lien. A judgment lien never attaches to fully exempt homestead property. Now, until 1901, the decision on whether something was fully exempt dealt with acreage. It did not concern value. After 1901, there was a value component. But the law, the rationale of the legislature and the Supreme Court decisions both pre-1900 and post-1900 did not change. And that is, a judgment lien does not attach to fully exempt homestead property. That, of course, raises the question, well, how do we determine whether property is fully exempt? Well, acreage is rather simple. You can go out and measure that. How do we determine the monetary component of that?
Let's go back to acreage. So if you had 200 acres and 200 acres, what was the acreage that would be exempt?
You know, I have to confess.
Let's just say 50 acres are exempt.
Okay, 50.
So then you get your judgment lien would be good on the other 100.
Yes, it would, Your Honor. And there is, there's a statute that talks about divisibility, et cetera, but the judgment lien would be good.
Right.
And the judgment lien is good if the value exceeds $40,000. By the value, I mean the equity. If the equity is greater than $40,000. Now, Mr. Vollmer says, well, we can determine value by a declaratory judgment action. You can ask the creditor to release. If he doesn't, you bring a declaratory judgment action. You can determine value by a foreclosure action. That's correct. But the legislature has provided in 815.18 sub 7.
815.18 sub 7. Okay.
That value means there can be determined in any commercially reasonable way. That is what the legislature has said here. And addressing Justice Babich's question, the legislature could easily say you have to bring that declaratory judgment action. You can't simply have an arm's length sale to determine value. I'm assuming that an arm's length sale obviously is commercially reasonable. But the legislature has said that in making the value determination on whether a homestead is fully exempt, commercially reasonable means may be used to determine value. And this court has held that private arm's length sales are commercially reasonable.
Counsel, if I'm writing this case as the author of the majority opinion and I support your cause, and I say, so I start to write it and I say, all the cases up except for EPF support this. But then I always like to add a little bit, and I say, it is the better rule of law as well, because. What do I say after because? Why is this the better rule of law?
I believe it's a better rule of law because otherwise you're going to have a declaratory judgment action. I believe no buyer is going to buy the property and no title insurance company is going to insure title absent a declaratory judgment, absent a judicial ruling, unless obviously the creditor will release.
You're making a commercial argument.
That's correct, Your Honor. It is a commercial argument because we have to remember that one of the purposes of the homestead exemption was to allow freedom of movement of the judgment debtor. He wasn't to be stuck in a particular homestead. Now, back in 1850, I presume there was no title insurance. And I think back in 1850, or when the law changed, a buyer certainly, if a declaratory ruling were required, or he couldn't rely upon an arm's length sale in determining whether the equities in that course, in that case there was no valuation, it was all acreage, but you would not have a sale of property. It could not take place absent some kind of a judicial ruling. And I think, as one of my co-counsel pointed out, you're not going to have buyers waiting around 3 or 4 years to get a judicial ruling, a declaratory judgment ruling saying, oh yes, the equity in this case is under $40,000 and therefore you may proceed without a lien. It's just not going to happen. So it is a commercial argument. And from the title insurance company's point of view, they have relied upon this 140 years of case law that suddenly evaporated 2 years ago in EPF. By the way, EPF is a Court of Appeals decision, and I think it doesn't need any citation of authority to say that that falls or is trumped by the long line of Wisconsin Supreme Court cases, specifically holding that judgment liens do not attach to fully exempt homestead property. The EPF decision holds otherwise. It is inconsistent with Wisconsin Supreme Court case law, and we also maintain statute. And as a final note, one of the reasons I am appearing here is if the court were to somehow change that law, it would be, I think, a remarkable change in direction, and I think the Court of Appeals realized that when it certified the issue to this court, that if this court were now to suddenly hold that a judgment lien does attach to fully exempt homestead property and survives a sale, which is contrary to 140 years of precedent, title insurance companies have written title policies, have agreed to take off a judgment lien when the title insurance company is satisfied that this is the homestead and that the equity is less than the $40,000. That's why they write these policies. That's why these properties are sold. Title insurance companies will no longer do that under EPF. And if EPF is retroactive, I believe it would violate the Sunburst Doctrine, and I don't believe that if EPF is embraced, it should be held to have any retroactive effect. I believe title companies are entitled to know that from now on, you're going to have a declaratory ruling from a court, or you're going to have the judgment creditor agree to take that lien off before a title policy is written.
Mr. Armstrong, before you sit down, what could Mr. Rummage have done to enforce this judgment lien against the Kemmeling property while Kemmeling was in it?
He was certainly entitled to bring a foreclosure action. If he wanted to avoid the uncertainty of a private sale, he has a right to bring a foreclosure action. And I know Mr. Vollmer says, well, you should have notice of that private sale. That might be something that the legislature should address. The statutes do not require notice of a private sale. But the judgment creditor always has the option of bringing a foreclosure action once he claims he's got a valid judgment on homestead property.
But under the circumstances of this case, that would have been an exercise in futility because there wasn't enough equity.
Well, that is correct, because the trial court determined there was not enough equity, so the judgment of foreclosure would have been denied. Mr. Rummage would have been responsible for the costs, because the statute provides that if you bring that foreclosure action and you do not have a lien, that you're responsible for the costs. And here, basically, what's happening, he's speculating. He knows if he brings that action then, he's not going to have $40,000. So let's wait. Let's wait and see what happens. And lo and behold, sure enough, now we've got a lot of equity 8 years later. I'm going to enforce the lien against a third party.
Is this really more of a question of not whether there's an attachment, but when it occurs?
Well, that's correct. That is a very good point. And I think this court has held that the determination occurs at the transfer. When a debtor transfers his property, if we're using the valuation on commercially reasonable arm's length sale, that is when the determination is made. That's what the Court of Appeals in remanding this case to the trial court held. That's what the trial court correctly held, and that's what this court has held for 140 years, that it's the time of transfer. So we look at the time of transfer, not down the road 8 years. It's the time of transfer when the debtor gives up his equity in the premises, moves out. We determine at that point whether there is a judgment lien on the property. That determination depends upon whether the property is fully exempt, and that is his equity is less than $40,000.
Thank you very much, Mr. Armstrong. Mr. Vollmer.
Thank you. With regard to the cases cited, Lights versus Bagamule was cited by Mr. Dubas. Mr. Dubas cited it for an action can be commenced. In Lights versus Bagamule, they took the proper procedure. They did ask for declaratory relief, saying that the judgment lien should not attach. They took the procedure necessary. That judgment liens are not are priorities to subsequent purchasers, which is another Mr. Dubas argument. R.A. Gurkey versus Mall, a 1941 case, and Upham versus Second Ward Bank both say if you acquire the property after the lien of the judgment attaches, it is not, the homestead does not take priority. So the subsequent buyers, Goldbergs, don't take priority. With regard to fully exempt, the last argument I just heard, that's outside the record at the courthouse. There's nobody at the courthouse that can tell it's fully exempt. There's nobody searching the record can tell it's fully exempt. It's a factual determination. It's a factual determination made between buyers and sellers, excluding the judgment creditor from that discussion. Whether it's fully exempt is not a title company determination. That the sky is falling. No real estate sales will take place. I've been closing real estate transactions for years. All these real estate transactions with homesteads have judgments on them. All of them have to be dealt with before you close. They do close, and they are dealt with. They're saying, well, if the judgment is this big, maybe it'll take some extra action because, wow, we can't pay a $5,000 judgment with the $20,000 coming out of here, or I want to take my homestead exemption and I have to deal with the judgment creditor. That's what the law provides. You have to deal with the judgment creditor.
Mr. Vollmer, I'm trying to decide whether your objection, is your objection to the process here in effect?
Yes.
That because this process wasn't followed, the statutory process that you say should have been followed, therefore they didn't get rid of Mr. Rummage's lien. Is that your real objection?
Correct. They didn't follow the process, and had they, my client would have had due process.
Well, had they followed the process, your client might have come out with a zero.
Well,
initially,
they
followed it when Kimmerling sold.
As the facts are, they couldn't because the sale was scheduled in a month and a half. The sheriff said.
Okay. Here's the example I made
sure.
up. There's $100,000 first mortgage, real estate taxes, first priority to you, okay? You then file a mortgage for a judgment credit. How much was your judgment?
My judgment was 100. What was your first?
100,000 is liens, priority liens.
Priority liens,
and
my judgment.
And in mine, I just said
case.
Your judgment is 150,000. Judgment credit.
All right.
Which makes a $250,000 debt on this property. Okay?
Correct.
And let's say we go through the process properly.
Correct.
And the price is $125,000. Sale price. Okay?
All right.
So out of that $125,000, we're going to first satisfy the first lien, the $100,000, right?
Correct.
And then $25,000 goes to Mr. Kimmerling because that's exempt as homestead, right?
If he claims the exemption.
The exemption. Okay. Now the buyer is going to take that property free and clear, right? Free and clear of your judgment lien.
Unless I object. If it's a sheriff's sale, I'm going to object and say it's not fair value. But if it's not a sheriff's sale, I guess... I didn't get a chance to object.
Okay, but I'm going to assume all of the appropriate procedures are set forth. You may object, but this is ultimately found fair market value. You've been given notice. You've had your day or days and weeks and years.
My day in court goes to sheriff's sale.
That's right, whatever it is.
Right.
And it's finally sold at $125,000.
Right.
The buyer gets it free and clear of your judgment lien.
Right, he's taken the necessary steps.
Right, and you have to do that, otherwise this guy can't ever sell that property. Kimberly,
no, he can ask my client to release it.
I know, but your real objection here is process. If the process was done properly, your lien can be cut from this real estate.
Could have been.
Could have been cut. And your objection here is the process wasn't followed, therefore your lien is still good.
Correct. And that the lien attaches, because that was the other argument, the priorities would be messed up. For example, if there's a mortgage, a homestead exemption,
right.
A judgment, and another mortgage.
Right.
If the lien never attached, that mortgage would be ahead of, the subsequent mortgage would be ahead of my judgment.
Okay, let's just look at that for a minute. So if you had a $100,000 first mortgage and a
$40,000 exemption.
Yeah. Then you have the exemption of $40,000.
And then a judgment.
And your judgment of $150,000, right.
And then another mortgage.
Of $100,000, right.
Right. If the lien never attached, is that mortgage prior because it attaches to my judgment? It has to attach. The lien has to attach or the priorities are messed up. The lien is there. It just, the mortgage behind it is subordinate to it, except for the exempt homestead, which there's a whole series of cases, by the way, which say if the judgment creditor settles for the 40, he can take his 40 and pay the mortgage that's subordinate. There are cases that say that. And all these cases which we're saying are inconsistent aren't. They're all consistent. If you read them, they all say the same thing. With regard to this 806.15.1, at 815.21 in subsection 2, they have to be read in conjunction with the definitions. And the definition, for example, in 815.21, the definition of the exemption is defined in 990.01, subsection 14. That's called homestead exemption, and it starts out with the title homestead exemption. It starts out, the exempt homestead is, and 990.13 is homestead, and the exemption and the exempt homestead and the homestead definitions are exactly the same until they get to the word 40 acres, and then there's a comma, and it says, but up to the value of 40,000, up to the value set in 815.21. The value set in 815.21 can change, but that's $40,000 at the time. At all, in this case, it was $40,000. I can't go to the courthouse and determine fully exempt. So I think that's a factual issue. And when you take the risk, as he's saying, title insurance companies are taking this risk, I don't see any closings not happening. I don't see any big problem going on here. I just see that there's a step that must be taken that they don't want to take. That step is take care of this judgment lien.
Thank you. Opposing counsel. That ends our hearing on 98-1276. The court will take a few moments recess.